The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
9:29, this Tuesday morning. Always good to have you with us. 51551 is the text number. I often refer to the internet as being like the Wild West with no sheriff, a lawless place where anyone can say or do anything. Unfortunately, it's still, for the large part, it can often be a cesspit. But Ian Urbina is an investigative journalist with the New York Times who has spent 5 years reporting, not the internet, but actually another fairly lawless place at the best of times, which is the ocean, the seas. It's called The Outlaw Ocean, the name of a book he's written on the basis of his investigations, and he joins us this morning. Ian, nice to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of all the places in all the world, how did you alight upon the sea as a subject of your studies?
I was interested in the sea since I was a little boy, and I was doing doctoral work on cultural anthropology, and took some time off and went and worked on a ship in Singapore, and it sort of opened my eyes to what a bizarre and fascinating place this was, and quite especially the people who work on these ships just sort of dazzled me.
I can understand why, because it's oftentimes it reads like something out of another era. The sea has a kind of timeless quality to it in terms of the language, the behavior, the etiquette.
Yeah, in a funny way, I felt like this to venture out into this space, into the world of these people, was one part time travel and one part space travel. You know, in the sense that you're essentially getting on a spaceship. You know, this ship, and you're heading beyond the horizon into a realm where the laws of time and the laws of physics aren't quite like they are for us landlubbers. Not to mention sort of the culture on these vessels, the hierarchy, the sort of code of conduct, all very different. And time really does get bent when you're out there and you're working for 9-12 months. And just the physical reality of the space, it's so sprawling, and Mother Nature sort of has her wrath to a degree that I'd never experienced on land.
Well, I suppose it's probably worth mentioning the Mare Liberum and put that into context, what that is.
Yeah, so Mare Liberum is this notion that freedom of the seas, and it is simply at its core the idea that the seas are free, and be they ship operators or companies or individuals, are allowed to pass through that space unfettered by governments. This is the spirit of the law that applies on the high seas, so outside of national waters, international waters, and sort of the direct jurisdictional limits that are put on it.
Okay, well, let's hit the water then and talk about some of the extraordinary things you see, including, again, an old-fashioned expression, but the bandit ship. What are they? And you talk about in chapter one, this storming the thunder. Could you take us through that?
Yeah, so the chase of the thunder was this epic story that somewhat landed in my lap. This was a story of a ship called the Thunder that had been engaged in illegal fishing for over a decade, specifically and especially down in Antarctica, in those waters in the Southern Ocean, and primarily fishing for toothfish, which on our menus might be called Chilean sea bass. And this ship had been illegally fishing down there and had racked up sort of an illicit tab of over $60 million. And no one seemed willing or able to bring it to justice. And so this vigilante conservation group, Sea Shepherd, decided they wanted to do something about it. This organization has a fleet of ships of its own. And they said, look, we're going to show the world, and to some degree shame developed world countries and their governments by proving that these guys can be caught and can be found in the first place. Interpol had ranked the Thunder as sort of the world's most wanted ship, and it was an arrest on site, purple notice on it. So Sea Shepherd went out, found these guys, and then for the next 110 days chased the Thunder from Antarctica to the coast of Africa, where ultimately the officers and the captain of the Thunder sunk their own ship so as to destroy the evidence that might lead to their prosecution.
And you meet these people on the high seas, and the characters you come across, like the Bates family, Roy and Michael Bates, who, you know, you couldn't write them, really, could you? You'd have to meet them.
That's quite right. Yeah, I mean, sometimes the characters were so colorful, as you mentioned, the Bates, a perfect example, that I wondered whether people would believe me. But the Bates family were these two men that decided they wanted to create their own micronation, their own principality. And Roy Bates knew about this gunnery platform off the coast of England that was at the time in international waters. It's now located in national waters because the line has shifted. But being in international waters and having been sort of an abandoned platform that was used to during the Second World War, Mr. Bates thought, well, I'm going to take over that platform and claim it as my own because it doesn't really belong to anyone at this point. And that began this long kind of crazy history of what some call the smallest micronation on planet Earth, Sealand. It has its own customs, its own passport, and it's really only the size of about 3 tennis courts. There have been, you know, British government attempted to take over it at one point. And so that chapter, then that story was just meant to show the kind of diversity of outlaw activity and characters that are out there.
Did you find when you're spending time out on the sea, did you find it to be lonely, or did it bring its own kind of, if you could have it, such a thing, a solitary company? Does that make sense at all? But, you know, the Mother Nature being on your side.
Yeah, it's funny you tap into that. I mean, I didn't intend to have a psychological kind of through line to this book, but the more time I spent on these ships and with these people, the more I became fascinated by, you know, kind of the stereotype of the curmudgeonly captain and what that was about, and also just the role that silence and sort of loneliness plays out there on these people that work this life. There are, you know, 50 million people that work at sea. And I do think it's a really addictive and alluring openness that is out there, both geographically and just also in terms of the lifestyle, divorced from the expectations of governments and laws and family on land. I also think it's dangerously lonely, as you say, and to some degree almost akin to solitary confinement. And I did find that some of those who come back to shore, having worked this type of work for a long time, had a real difficult time readjusting, myself included, almost a PTSD that you might think of soldiers having.
And when you were recovering from that, what was it? Was it just the noises of people, the people and places and sounds?
Yeah, it's the level of interaction you get home. I have kids and a spouse, and just sort of the speed of daily life and the amount of information that's coming in at you at all times. It's also just your sense of space is very different. You know, I found myself accustomed to sleeping in extremely small quarters, you know, coffin-like bunks on these ships. And then when I got home, this huge bed just felt weirdly agoraphobic. And it's just the bustle of life and the emotional complexity of life on land is different than what you experience on
a
ship.
And did you have a class of maritime Stockholm syndrome? Did you kind of fall in love with life on the sea, even though you mightn't have loved it as much as you loved it too much? Do you know what I'm saying?
No, I do quite. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit stereotypic, but in these prison movies, you know, you always have that element of the prisoner who sort of seems to want to go back to his cell, and I do feel like these ships are prison cells to some degree, but in an odd way, it's home. And there's so much beautiful out there and alluring and incredible. And the camaraderie of life on these ships is alluring too. But yeah, I do think that I found myself becoming more comfortable in that space.
What did you find any of the superstitions to be particularly bonkers?
For some reason, the whole whistling thing, you know, you're not ever supposed to whistle on board, and then people take it. And I never really, I'm sure one of your listeners will immediately know what the etymology of that is, but I didn't ever find out why you're not supposed to whistle. But I just found that really strange. And a couple of times when I tested the limits, I was quickly informed that that was not a joking matter.
And that's whistling as in, as opposed to using a whistle in your hand like a... there's a difference between... You know, because you know in Star Trek when they... I know it's a different type of ship, but it's still, they use the language of the nautical world. And that's they'll be talking about the... You know that sort of whistle that you might hear?
That's right.
Is that bad luck, or where did that come from, I wonder?
I don't know. I think whistling with your mouth is its own distinct thing. I think the whistle on Star Trek, I always thought was coming from one of the machines. But yeah, I don't know.
Oh yeah, I have no doubt. But I think probably from Once Upon a Time there must be. Anyway, I don't know. Let's move on. I've taken us into the stars, and that's not where we're meant to be today. We're meant to be on the high seas. Let's go back to the sea and tell me Ian about, because I did find it intriguing. How do you deal with vagabonds and thieves and so on? On a boat, and you sort this out with us. Answer this first on chapter six about jail without bars. Can you just talk us through what they do, the rafting?
Yeah, so I think one of the chapters, through time, the sea has been this metaphor for escape, you know, for freedom, the ultimate form of freedom. Mm. And I think that is true and has driven a lot of people to head there. At the same time, I found an escape for some, a prison for others. And I wanted to look at the various ways in which people get trapped out there. And so in that chapter, I was looking at different examples. So number one, I looked at the extent to which, for example, in the post 9/11 era, the U.S. government and others had resorted to using the extra legal nature of the high seas and the space out there and the remove from lawyers and journalists and the like, and taken advantage of that to detain terrorism suspects and engage in methods of interrogation, you might call torture, that they couldn't get away with on land. That was one category I looked at. Another was stowaways, you know, these sort of hobos of the sea that are aiming to travel from A to B and mean to pass through the sea, across it. Many of them get stuck on board, and I looked at one story in particular, a dramatic story of two Tanzanian stowaways that boarded a ship in Cape Town and were discovered while at sea and brought up on deck and then put on a raft, a makeshift raft, and cut free, and the ship left them there. And these two guys didn't know how to swim, and they were on essentially a tabletop with some oil drums beneath them, and sort of their epic struggle to stay alive and stay on top. And they eventually washed up on shore in Liberia. One of them died, the other lived, and was able to track that guy down, actually right near the same port, trying to stow away again in a shanty town, and just sort of capture his story of what it was like being abandoned out there. And that's not an unusual rafting, as that's called, mm-hmm. is not an unusual way that stowaways get handled. If you're not going to kill them directly, then you're going to sort of set them free, if you will, in that fashion.
I mean, it's just a whole other world order, isn't it? And this comes to pass then when you talk about also the transshipment ships in chapter 10, where these are extraordinary ships, that fishing ships, that are very far out at sea and never come into port. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there's been this global crisis. This is where environmental concerns intersect with human rights concerns.
Yes.
So because of overfishing near shore, there's a lot less fish to be caught near the coast. And so ships have to go much further away to catch a bare minimum to break even. And that gave rise to this method of fishing in which the fishing boats just stay out there indefinitely, sometimes for years, and they keep fishing continuously rather than come all the way back to shore. So in some cases, you have Thai ships off the coast of Somalia, for example, and they'll stay fishing. And then mother ships will come out, bring ice and men and fuel and food and whatever parts, and then they bring the fish back to shore. And those transshipment vessels, those fish ships that stay out, are really unusually brutal places, and they often are, you know, they're prone to using migrant captive labor. And so I wanted to get on board those and chronicle life and work on them.
Would you tell us one of them, your stories about the Thai officers and how that worked in terms of being shanghaied and trafficked?
So sea slavery is this term that sort of, in my mind, refers to a spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, you have workers, migrants mostly, that are being literally kidnapped, right? Mm. And on the other end of the spectrum, and I'll come back to this, you have softer forms of trafficking, no, in some ways no less brutal, but more subtle. And that's debt bondage, right? So in the two models on that spectrum, imagine Thailand, middle-class country, less than 2% unemployment. You know, Thais are not taking the worst of jobs. Mm. The women are not in the sex industry, mostly, and the men are not on the fishing boats. These are migrant workers from nearby, very poor, violence-prone, war-torn countries, Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar. And so migrants flow in illegally across the border, desperate for jobs. They take these awful jobs, and some of them are shanghaied. So, you know, a Cambodian guy might be at a bar. A ship captain at port, and he is short two men. He's got to get out of slip within 24 hours, and he needs some workers fast. He talks to the right guy. That right guy knows a brothel owner. That brothel owner drugs a guy. Guy passes out. Next thing he knows, he's awake on a ship. He's a Cambodian guy that just got shanghaied, and he'll be at sea for a year.
Good Lord. And he just wakes up, and having been in one position, excuse the expression, one minute, and then the next thing he's on the boat.
That's right.
Good Lord.
I mean, it's something, it's hard to even believe when you hear these stories, but I heard them enough times to believe them.
Okay. And they're stuck on that boat then as essentially slaves.
Yeah, I mean, so in the case that we focused on initially in the piece that ran on the front page of the Times, there was one such guy, a Cambodian guy, and he was debt bonded into this job and ended up on a ship, and off they went. And when he tried to escape, he jumped overboard and tried to swim to a mothership that had come to resupply. He was caught, brought back on board, and for the rest of the year that he was on that ship before he was sold to another, he was shackled by the neck at any time when he was not working. And, you know, that story we put on the front page, it's part of what got a lot of attention on this whole problem.
In part of your series for the New York Times. And I presume if you're a sailor or you're stuck on a ship in as a slave or in some class of human traffic, you see the Stella Maris charity emerging, the Star of the Sea, to come and help you. These are pretty important people if you're in trouble on the high seas.
Yeah, so there's this really inspiring sort of underground railroad of advocates who, like you say, Stella Maris is one such. Mission to Seafarers is another that are based in ports. They're often very small, underfunded outfits, and their duty is to look out for fishers and seafarers, and often they're intervening when either these guys are, and it's mostly a male world, are sort of abandoned on a ship and the ship is just stuck there, and the owner of the ship has sort of disappeared to the wind, and these guys don't know what to do. They can't get off and come to land. Or in these more acute settings, mostly in the developing world context, where deckhands are essentially sea slaves, and when they see a chance to escape, they jump off the ship, swim to shore, and run away. And that's when these organizations, these human rights groups, intervene and try to help them escape. And meanwhile, they're in a foot race against the, you know, the bounty hunters that work for the port and the ship captains, and they're looking to find the guys and bring them back to the ship as quickly as possible.
Ian, there's an enormous amount of people texting into the program to give us the rundown on the whistling and the wind.
Mm-hmm.
So
as much.
Yeah.
I put that on you for opening.
I will accept all accusations of starting such a peculiar conversation. But you wrote the book.
I should have known. Okay. That's a fair point.
No. I'll accept all responsibility. Anyway, Miles is in Doolittle. We're an island nation, as you know, Ian. So we're yes. There's a lot of interest in this subject.
Yeah.
Miles says that whistling on a ship summons the wind. Now, a lot of people are saying the same thing. Whistling at sea is bad luck, says Trevor in Donegal. In maritime folklore, it's said to challenge the wind itself and can bring about a storm. And another says, in olden days, sailing ships used to whistle up a wind, so whistling brings the wind. Now, my question is then, do you want the wind if it's a calm day and you want wind in the sails, or is it, I think more people are suggesting it's a challenge to the wind, that the wind gets annoyed with you whistling at it. I'm not sure.
Tempting fate.
Linda says, to whistle on a boat is to call up the wind. On a sailboat, this could be hazardous. The whistle on Star Trek, oh great, she's covering all acts, is a copy of the bosun's whistle, which meant officer on board. Ah, right, so when Picard or Kirk, whoever you're watching, comes on board, that's the noise. Regarding fishermen's pishogues, the whistles, while on trawlers, Kevin Karen Carrigline says, whistle for rain, hum for fog, never marry a woman who looks like a dog. I mean, you cannot. Obviously, this is going back to the last century. I'm going to throw that completely on Kevin Carroll before we're frog marched out of the off the island by the usuals. Right, back in the last century, it goes on and on and on. So now we know what the whistling situation is, Ian. That's the there's a whole book in that, I suspect. But isn't it funny how I always feel when I'm ever out in the sea, because I love going out on the sea, and whether it's fishing for mackerel on a little boat or just going to an island or whatever, you know the word that the good people of America kind of adopted and overuse, which is awesome. And you know they said, my coffee is awesome. It's not. It's just coffee and it's tasty and it's hot. But the sea is awesome. You saw that awe. Yeah, with awe, I presume. You know where I'm going with this.
It was an awesome experience.
Correct, in the correct context.
Exactly. It is an awe-inspiring place.
But what I'm saying is that it almost feels, if the sea and we as humans and the land were all characters in a play, the sea has its role.
Yeah.
And it should be respected.
That's right. Yeah, I think, and those who don't spend time out there, and I think also, it's one thing to visit with the sea. It's another thing to actually cross it. And the longer you spend out there, the more intense the sense of respect you have for it. I'm speaking in platitudes now, but I do think that time plus that space is what I did not imagine would affect me as much as just visiting the space for short stints.
I can well imagine. Ian, your book is called The Outlaw Ocean, Crime and Survival in the Last Untamed Frontier. Intriguing insight into such a vast and awesome phenomenon. It's been good to talk to you. Thank you for your time this morning.
Awesome, thank you.
Awesome. I can't accept that, but I appreciate your time nonetheless.
Cheers.
We've got to get some music now, because Beezer from Inishannon says, back in the last century, myself and another lad were singing, sitting on the dock of a bay with obviously the Otis Redding beautiful song on the Asgard. And we got to the whistling part, and the captain came up from his cabin with a serious face on him and gave us a right rollicking, and he told us, stop whistling, as we could whistle up a storm.